This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
The Christian view of resurrection. One approach to the resurrection, of course, in Christianity is the resurrection of Jesus Christ, for which, of course, the Christian church claims that there is not only historical evidence, but that Christ was changed in the resurrection. So he comes back, as it were, with a spiritual body, as St. Paul calls it. He comes back transformed and, promises his disciples the same resurrection from the dead.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you. That's the voice of Father Robert Spitzer. He'll be joining us in just a moment. I thought today we could kick off the program with something a little bit different. Let's take a look at your future. Yeah, your resurrected body. You know, when you die, I hope we pass this great test called life. I hope we grow in virtue. I hope that we accept God's mercy and not reject it, so we're not spending an eternity separated from him. When we rise, you know, what happens to the body? You know, we know what happened with Christ, right? Christ could move at the speed of thought. He could pass through, you know, doors and be in locked rooms. The body could still eat. What happens to your body, the resurrected body? The gospel reading sees Jesus suddenly appear in the upper room, right, where the disciples are gathered. And this happened after our Lord appeared to the two disciples on the way to Emmaus. You heard that, I think the other day we heard that. Look, you got to remember what was going on at the time. Their rabbi, their leader, you know, their loved companion, Jesus was crucified. Right? He was brutally put to death. They were distraught at what happened on that Good Friday. And they probably didn't believe the women and what they reported, really. I mean, really, Jesus is risen from the dead? So Jesus joins them as they're walking on the road, and the two of them don't recognize him until after they reach their destination. They recognized him in the breaking of the bread, and Jesus' resurrected body is completely unlike our own. As I said, it's able to disappear at will, to go through solid objects. It's ghost-like, but it's not a ghost, right? The thing is that we're supposed to get similar bodies. What will your body look like? How old will you be? What are the capabilities of it? As St. Paul tells us in his first letter to the Corinthians, if you go to chapter 5, you can read this. He says, "For just as in Adam all die, so too in Christ shall all be brought to life." And I think a lot of that, you know, I don't know how about you, but I think a lot of people tend to interpret that as being brought to spiritual life, right? But in the context of the letter, it's not only spiritual reality, it is a physical reality as well. Our bodies will be resurrected on the last day. I don't know how often you think about it. I was contemplating that actually a little bit earlier today as I was preparing for the show. I have not spent a whole lot of time pondering the resurrected body, but it is a fascinating topic, and it is a fascinating reality. Now, the Catechism of the Catholic Church is really clear on this, and I often recommend two books for your spiritual library. I could probably recommend 100, but two absolute musts, the Bible and the Catechism. You ever question about the faith, you go to the Catechism, right? So I opened it earlier today, and here's what it says. It says, "God in his almighty power will definitely grant incorruptible life to our bodies by reuniting them with our souls through the power of Jesus' resurrection." So that's your hope, right? If you believe, if you buy in, let's say, to the atheist, then all that happens is you live on earth for a while, and then you die, and your bodies are buried, and they rot away. I have a brother-in-law who I love. He's a good man. He's generous as can be. He doesn't really believe in God. His father, I think, was actually a Methodist pastor at one point in time, and this guy fell away from the faith. And he says to me, "Drew, I just don't believe that we go on beyond this life. You know, you're no different than roadkill." That's his mindset. That's it. That's all the meaning there is to life for him. And I guess what he leaves behind. But he doesn't believe we go beyond this world. And as St. Paul says, let us eat, let us drink, for tomorrow we die. You know, if that's the case, then, you know, we're only here for a time, we die and rot. But that's not the case, right? And you can read so much about those who've had near-death experiences. We can learn so much from Christ and his post-resurrection experiences. You can learn so much from Father Robert Spitzer, who's joining us today. He hails, of course, from the Majus Institute. You can find out more at majuscenter.com or spitzercenter.com. But one of the most brilliant people I know, and he'll take us through all that you need to know about the resurrected body today. If you have a question or a comment or you want to call, feel free to dial in 888-914-9149. Father, welcome back. It's always good to talk with you.
Always great to be with you too, Drew.
Yeah, great subject. I always love, you know, I don't contemplate the resurrected body that much, but reading about impassibility and all these different features that the resurrected body will have, this isn't something you often think about, but share this a little bit. I mean, what happens after we die? What was the body of Christ like in these resurrected occurrences? Maybe that's a good place to start. And the big question that always comes up is, well, why didn't people recognize him? He told Magdalene, don't cling to me, right? Yeah. The apostles on the way to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him. How do you not recognize a man you spent years with? You know, so bring us through this. What happened in terms of their cognition, the fact that they could not recognize him, and what was different about the resurrected Lord?
Yeah, I'll just maybe answer that in first your last question first, and then your first question last. So first, you know, what's the ultimate transition of Jesus's body when he appears to the apostles? I'm going to just move away for just a second from, you know, how did he appear to, you know, in the resurrection scenes? Mm-hmm. But what was his appearance fully to the apostles? He appears in glory. And St. Paul has probably the most vivid description of it in 1 Corinthians 15. So as you're kind of looking at that, Paul is talking about he's going to be not just embodied. So he's not just going to be a resuscitated corpse that kind of lives on. You know, like his physical body gets up and still subject to physical laws. Nothing like that. Paul calls him a pneumatikon soma. He calls him a spiritual body. And then he goes on to say in the same chapter, 1 Corinthians 15, he goes on to say he's, you know, powerlessness becomes going to be empowered. That sort of this ignominiousness is going to become glorious, and he says the corporeality is going to become immortal, and so he goes on to describe these characteristics that are, you know, sort of Greek ways of trying to get around to one big massive conclusion: the body of Jesus is glorious. It is powerful. It is godlike. It is literally like a theophany. It's mind-blowing. It's not just that it's spiritual. Oh, it's definitely spiritual, but it's like super, it's super beautiful. It's super glorious. It's super powerful. And so that's what, you know, Paul, you know, tries to describe the body as. And I'll talk about the gospel accounts in a moment. Mm-hmm. But then continuing to answer that question, Paul goes on to say, but it's not just Jesus's body. At the end time, right, so I'm just going to call this, ultimately our bodies, says St. Paul, will be like Jesus's body. It'll be spiritual. It'll be glorious. It will be powerful. It will be beautiful. So that's the essence of what we will ultimately become. Now, just to back up into the near-death experiences for just a moment, let me just talk about those and talk about what, you know, my theory is that this is going to happen in two stages, and I think that's right with what Paul is, St. Paul is saying. So, first of all, when we die, what do these, you know, medical, studies of near-death experiences tell us? Well, first of all, they tell us that the roadkill hypothesis is very probably incorrect. In other words, that we do, in fact, have a transphysical soul. And by the way, that the Samuel Parnia study, if people just want to go to that 2014 study, which included 2,060 patients, and just read how carefully done this University of Southampton study was, published in Resuscitation, Journal of Resuscitation, which is very high-end peer-reviewed journal. If you just want to take a look at that, it's there online for free. Just put in Parnia, P-A-R-N-I-A, just Parnia near-death study, and you'll get it in the Journal of Resuscitation. Here's the upshot of what medical science is finding in careful studies. And Parnia by no means is the only one. Pim van Lommel's study, et cetera, published in The Lancet, number one peer-reviewed journal, a medical journal in Great Britain, et cetera, will give you the very same conclusions. But first of all, it's very likely that you have a transphysical soul that will survive bodily death. So when you die, this soul will emerge from your body, or what I'm going to call this spiritual body is going to emerge from your physical body. And your spiritual body not only can see and hear, but it can also voluntarily move. It is not subject to physical laws, so it can go through walls. And we have literally thousands of accounts of people in hospitals who go through the walls of the operating room into the waiting rooms next door, or literally through the wall of the hospital to the outside of the hospital, and they're floating around out there. They're certainly not subject to gravity. They can float up or down as fast as they want. And they certainly also can appear, or they can't appear and disappear quite yet in the way that Jesus does. We'll talk about that in a moment. But they have remarkable transphysical powers, and certainly they don't need their physical body. They are seeing, they are hearing, they are remembering. All of their physical, thoughts are, completely intact. Their remembrances of themselves, their relatives. In fact, their memory is even more acute in their transphysical state than it is in their bodily state. So, like, these little results of Alzheimer's don't show up. They're, that might be impediments of the brain. When you come out, your memories are intact. So you look at that and you go, okay, that's amazing. The description of the resurrected body goes way beyond these near-death accounts. And now we are also told that those bodies, they don't just stay around the hospital. In many cases, those bodies will wind up going into a heavenly domain, a beautiful domain. Occasionally, they go into a dark and terrifying domain. About 1% of the cases seem to manifest this. But most of the time, they'll go into a beautiful domain. In that beautiful domain, they'll encounter a loving white light. And the things around them will be incredibly beautiful. And yet, still, with all these descriptions and all these remarkable things that are happening, it still falls short of the descriptions that St. Paul and the other gospel writers, which I'll talk about in a moment, are talking about in terms of the risen body of Christ, which will become, according to St. Paul, our risen bodies. So how does that work? When do we get the supercharge? When do we get the glory and the power? Because really, when you're outside of your body, when you have died, what people report is, yes, you're not subject to physical laws. Yes, you do have healing. You don't feel pain anymore. So if you were suffering in your body or you had memory problems in your body, you're not going to have those anymore. So you do overcome that. You have a sense of the presence of other people, and you can communicate with them, and they with you, without even using audible words through your mouth. I mean, you can just think. And they can understand. If you want them to understand, they'll understand. And they communicate with you in the same way and so forth. So the idea there is, okay, that's really good, but what Paul's talking about is almost like this transformed, glorious, powerful, godlike appearance. Are we really going to have that? St. Paul says, yes, you're really going to have that. And my thought is that we stay in this kind of, what I'm going to call this, spiritual state for a long, long time, and maybe, maybe at the end of the world or some other later period when we're fully incorporated into the heavenly kingdom, whatever that may be, but at a later period, we get the supercharge into the glorious body in which Christ manifested himself, because that's not altogether present when you die. But you do have the spiritual component. You definitely have the transphysical component. You're not subject to physical laws. You definitely have the healing component, where you're not feeling physical pain or physical impediments anymore. And you certainly have the component and the awareness of the love of others, and especially the love of God. So all that you do have, but the supercharge you don't. So so that gets kind of to the, now we get to the, well, what about those gospel descriptions? How can these people not recognize Jesus? Well, because Jesus can appear any way he wants. I mean, now that he has risen from the dead, he can definitely appear in any physical form that he would want. He could manifest his true, overwhelming, glorious form, and he does do that in three gospel accounts, but Matthew's gospel account is pretty clear, right? When Jesus appears to the disciples after the resurrection, they all fall down and worship. So that pretty much tells you they are experiencing a theophany, an appearance of God, right? So they think they're seeing God, and what's the appropriate thing to do when you're seeing God? Well, you bow, you fall down and worship. And of course, Jesus says very clearly in Matthew's gospel, when he's being tempted by the devil, "You shall worship the Lord your God alone. Him alone shall you serve." So the idea is worship is reserved for God, and that's what the apostles are doing in Matthew's gospel. And then there's this strange comment. No one dared to ask him, you know, well, we'll talk about that in John's gospel, but they said that some doubted. Well, what did they doubt? Well, they didn't doubt that Jesus was appearing. They're all falling down and worshiping. They're not doubting that Jesus is appearing. So what are they doubting? They're doubting, is this glorious, remarkable appearance, is this Jesus or is this God? Well, as it turns out, then Jesus reveals himself to them and, of course, says, "It's me. It's Jesus." And, of course, it's exact reverse, the mirror image, if I could say, of right. The ministry. In the ministry, they see Jesus, you know, as his physical body and his identity as Jesus. But, of course, they, you know, see dimly that, okay, right. Through the miracles and other manifestations, they see, okay, he's God. But now, in the post-resurrection period, they see, oh my gosh, here's God. Is that Jesus? And of course, Jesus says, yes, it's me. Now go out and preach the gospel to all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and Son and the Holy Spirit, and recall everything that I taught you, and know that I'm with you always, even until the end of the age. So that's Matthew's account. So you say, well, is that the same kind of thing in Luke? Absolutely, it's in Luke. Because if you look at this narrative, remember, Luke is trying to, he wants to include very definitely Jesus' manifestation of himself through the wounds. So we see that in both John's gospel and Luke's gospel. And in Luke's gospel, which is the one for today, Jesus appears, and of course, the first thing is they thought they were seeing a ghost or a spirit. Right. Now, there's the spiritual body component, but along with it, you have these three different words for terror and fright and awe. Now, normally, awe and this kind of what we might call holy terror, right, that is reserved for God. So, you know, again, you've got this sort of, Lucan signal that there is really almost a divine-like, terrifying, awe-like quality to the person who is appearing as a spirit. So there is kind of that hint in Luke's gospel. But remember, Luke's facing a problem, of really sort of a docetistic kind of problem there, where people are denying, that Jesus is, continuity between his physical body and his spiritual body. And so Luke, you know, he wants to emphasize that Jesus is still manifesting those wounds. And so he does, and of course has the element there of touching him and so forth. Now, John's gospel, John, also you take, oh no, John's gospel, that seems, Jesus seems to be very human-like. And just remember, John is cryptic. That's the one thing you have to remember. So, for example, if you look at John's gospel, he, first of all, how does Jesus appear? Poof! He comes right through the closed doors, right, and into this room, and he doesn't, he goes right through matter. So, first of all, that's atypical. That's not a physical body anymore. That clearly manifests the spiritual body component. But John uses the same words, that there is this holy awe, there's this terror that comes over them, and Jesus has to reassure them twice, peace be with you. And so he assures them twice because they're you know, experiencing this awe, this terror, this fright. So then you look at it, and John's word for Jesus in the gospel. Now, you have to be, remember, John's cryptic, so you have to read what he's doing here. John never, in the minute prior to the resurrection, never uses the term ha kurios of Jesus. Ha kurios, that's with the definite article, the Lord. Mm-hmm. Ha kurios is the Greek translation for Yahweh or Adonai, which is the name for God. Now, he never uses that of Jesus prior to the ministry, because what the apostles see is Jesus. So when you Jesus appears, they see Jesus prior to the resurrection. Now you go after the resurrection, and what does John do? He starts only using, on the lips of the apostles, the only word used is ha kurios. So notice then that the narrator will tell you, right, Jesus appears on the shore. But what is it that the apostles see? What is it that Thomas sees? Ha kurios mou, ha theos mou, the Lord of me, the God of me. Right? So again, with that ha kurios, the Lord, the divine name, ha theos, God himself, the nature of God. Right? So they're seeing God. And of course, that cryptic statement in John 21, there they are, mm-hmm, eating on the beach, and John puts in this cryptic statement, and no one dared to ask him, who are you?
Right.
For they knew very well it was ha kurios, the Lord with the definite article, the divine name.
Hold the thought there. When we come back, we will talk more. In fact, I'll take calls if you have questions about the glorified body, what it will be like, what powers it possesses. St. Thomas Aquinas, you know, he famously talked about the seven different qualities that the resurrected body will have. We can talk about that and more. Stay with me.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
When a person leaves, for example, the operating room or the hospital and goes to this otherworldly domain that everybody calls heaven, when they get there, the first thing they say, the very first thing is, all suffering comes to an end. So if there was psychological pain, it's gone. If there was physical pain, it's gone. If there was a physical deficiency like eyesight, it's restored. I mean, and you're restored to, you know, what your body should have and could have been, you know, in your lifetime, or would have been in your lifetime, you know, had you not had such a deficiency, that, let's say, from, you know, in my case, a genetic deficiency in my vision or something. Right. All of that is completely restored. But the next thing they say, after that suffering is completely gone, the second thing they say is, it's beautiful.
The Drew Mariani Show is on Relevant Radio. You are never alone.
God bless Relevant Radio.
The Drew Mariani Show is on Relevant Radio.
That, of course, is Father Robert Spitzer. He's also joining me today, and we're taking a look at the resurrected body. You and I will have a resurrected body, and it's pretty amazing, the properties and the qualities that we have. St. Thomas Aquinas talked about seven properties that the glorified body will have. and it'd be kind of cool to have them right now. What he talked about, what he called impassibility, right? He talked about agility. He talked about subtlety. He talked about clarity, sometimes also referred to as brilliance, and they go on and on. What is it about the glorified body? What was it that the apostles didn't recognize the Lord? Why did the Lord tell Magdalene, don't cling to me? And what about some of those other questions, if you've ever thought about it? Remember the story of the Sadducees? They were asking Jesus about the woman who married seven brothers, and Jesus told them, you know, that, you know, we'll kind of be like angels, you know, we'll be in spirit, but what's that mean, right? After Christ's resurrected body, he still had nails and wounds in his hands and his feet, right, in his open side. Do we keep the battle scars to show the victory of Christ? You know, what about the martyrs? What about near-death experiences? What does the shroud reveal? I mean, there's so much to talk about. How does the transfiguration, when we saw him on Mount Tabor, does that differ from his resurrected body? Father, let's. You know, there's so much to talk about. I'm just throwing stuff on the wall here for you. But, you know, let me start with the last question first. I've often thought about that. Those apostles marveled at the beauty, the radiance, the magnificence of you know, Moses and Elijah and of Christ when they transfigured. Was that a prelude to the resurrected body? Did they see the resurrected body in that account? Or how does that differ from Jesus Christ's resurrected body?
Well, they saw certainly a prefigurement of that resurrected body. Now, whether that was the full-on resurrected body that made the apostles bow down and worship, that got John to change his vocabulary to start using hakurios of Jesus as the obvious factor that the apostles were seeing in the appearances, right. I'm not sure about that. But certainly it's a prefigurement. So, right. In other words, the attempt to describe it filled with light, filled with glory, right. That's overwhelming Peter, right? They're looking at this in awe. And again, there's that, you know, that awe. And remember, awe is not just, you know, just being taken up in the beauty. It's also almost a terror. It's so shockingly and overwhelmingly, you know, godlike. So there's an overpowering element as well as a beautiful element that's part of it. It has that godlike feature. Now, that part, not so sure that was there in the Transfiguration, but right. It might have been, and maybe not related, but it certainly is a prefigurement of the glory of the risen body to come.
And again, this radiance, you know, I really believe that when we die, when we when we cross to the other side, I mean, I think everything there radiates the beauty of God. You know, those who have near-death experiences, as you know, they say you could look at a blade of grass there for an eternity, because it's unlike the sun that reflects, you know, off of objects, everything radiates the light of God. And we know in Scripture, Matthew tells us that, you know, he is the light, right? He is the light, Scripture tells us. Look at Matthew. We're told that when Jesus comes again, it'll be on a cloud, you know, of heaven with power and great glory. The radiance that comes with the resurrected body. Talk about that for a moment. It's a brilliance that is blinding, yet does not hurt the eye. Explain that to me, if you could.
Yeah, I mean, it's again, it's so difficult to say, you know, when like in the near-death experiences, that radiance seems to be somewhat subdued. Obviously, there is a light that comes from people. So, for example, when you move to the other side and you go to that beautiful heavenly domain, and let's suppose your relatives are coming down to see you and to greet you, they do definitely radiate a beauty, and they do definitely have a luminosity that they didn't have in their physical bodies, and it's coming from within them. It's not reflected, as you put it, from the sun. So that is true. Now, if, you know, Jesus, you know, seems to have a radiance that is so overpowering that radiance causes the apostles to almost think that that's God appearing. So the glory and the beauty and the power is so intense, the majesty is so intense, that they really are bowing down and worshiping. So juncture, you know, we haven't seen that in near-death experiences, but yet that is what St. Paul promises. He says, we will be like him. And so the same thing in John's first epistle, right? We shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. So again, the idea of us being like Jesus in that risen state. So how else to describe it? Yeah. You know, we will have that quality. And now with Jesus, if you look at the evidence of the Shroud of Turin,
yep.
The only way you're going to physically produce that image on the shroud is you're going to have what's called vacuum ultraviolet radiation, which is an intense high frequency form of light that for 1/40 billionth of a second, and that would be on the magnitude of somewhere between 6 to 8 billion watts.
Whoa.
Which is like having 500,000 searchlights worth of light energy coming from that body. Now that's pretty intense.
Wow.
And if you look at that and you try and analogize that, can you imagine something like that appearing before you? You'd be bowing down and falling down and worshiping too. We all would, because we would really believe that this was God appearing. So
that's part of the theory like too, Father, isn't it, on how the image itself got inflected onto the Shroud of Turin, as we know it now.
Yeah.
The body levitated somehow, a burst of high-frequency energy inflected that image on there?
Yeah, that's right, because if you did not really have an intensity that great, you could never have produced a perfect three-dimensional photographic negative image on a non-photographically sensitive cloth.
Yeah.
So you couldn't have done it. I mean, you can't explain this with heat. You can't explain it with dyes. You can't explain it with liquids, rubs, anything. So you're left with light, and it's really just sitting right
amazing.
On the uppermost surface of the fabric's fibrils. So when you look at that, the only way you can possibly do that is with an intense burst of ultraviolet radiation.
Yeah.
But it can only be for 1/40 billionth of a second. Otherwise, light of that magnitude would literally turn the shroud into not even carbon smoke. I mean, the smoke would be eliminated. So
true. Well, I guess today's Father Robert Spitzer. Father, let's take a few calls for you, and we'll let you get in. You know how quickly time goes. If you want to join us, it's 888-914-9149. I remember reading St. Teresa of Avila, too. She once said that the Lord transforms a soul so that it seems no longer to be itself or even its own likeness. And that, to me, makes me think of these experiences on the road to Emmaus or other places, why the apostles, didn't recognize the Lord. It's a totally different reality.
He could also cause his appearance to be changed, because remember, he's not limited to a single physical appearance as he was in his incarnate physical body. Now he's in a glorified body, and so he can, whatever appearance he would like to have, he can choose, and chooses one to, he wants everybody to identify him in their hearts. So, of course, it's his voice and the tone of his voice and the content that gets Mary Magdalene to recognize him in her heart. And, of course, it's the Emmaus people, right? He wants to reel them in their hearts. So he comes and he just looks like an ordinary kind of guy, right? He doesn't have to appear in his glory. He doesn't have to appear, in his transphysical glory or in his previous physical self. So he appears as some ordinary Joe walking down the road, and he's trying to get these guys to recognize him. And finally, he says, let me tell you about what you were hoping for. I'm going to reveal the scriptures to you. So, of course, he's got them hooked now. I mean, they're listening to this guy going, how does he know all this stuff, right? And, of course, he's reeling them in. And as he's kind of reeling the rod in, and he gives him more and more information, he says, well, I got to go now. No, don't go. Why don't you come in with us? We've got some extra food here, spend the night. So, and, of course, they're inviting him, and the heart's got him recognized. And finally, of course, in the breaking of the bread, oh, my gosh, it's him. And, of course, they recognize him right then and there, at which point they say, we're not our hearts, right? Soaring. We're not our hearts, raised, while he was speaking to us on the road. And so, that's Jesus's technique. Most of the time in our own spiritual life, he does that. He doesn't, directly manifest himself in an obvious way.
You're right.
But, of course, he's very present. And then he kind of gradually hooks us in to our heart, through our desire to want to see him, through our desire to kind of open ourselves to him in our freedom. And then the more we open ourselves to him, more we use our freedom in the right way, look at what happens.
Right?
I mean, all of a sudden he becomes really obvious and you kind of get it. And so that happens to us a lot, too. I mean, it certainly happened to me in my life. You know, I'm thinking, gee, I haven't had some consolation in prayer for a while. And then all of a sudden, you know, gradual manifestation, one after the next, and kablamo.
I love it.
And he puts it right on you.
Let's do this, Padre. We'll go to Paul, who's listening to us in Niles, Michigan. He'll kick it off today. Hi, Paul. Good afternoon.
Hi. Good afternoon, Drew and Father. Yeah, I'm just curious at what point this would happen to us. I mean, you've talked about when people die and they have, you know, an afterlife experience and then come back to life. But if we die and go to purgatory, at what point would we have the possibility of experiencing this if we're lucky enough?
Well, here's the point. I'll just call it stage one and stage two. I think, you know, on stage one, when you die, I think your transphysical soul, which includes a bodily component, but not a physical bodily component. So you have, you know, some form of extension and recognizable appearance. I think that emerges from your physical body immediately after your death, even if you go to purgatory, even if you go directly to heaven. So, I mean, if you just stay in the hospital room, right, which some people don't go to a heavenly domain, they just stay in the hospital room immediately after you die and lose consciousness. In fact, sometimes, even if you are just in an intense coma, your transphysical soul, that as I said, which includes that corporeal component, that extended appearance of a body, that will leave your body and be present immediately upon your death, or even a strong coma. But now, once you are in like stage one, what happens in purgatory? I do not know what happens in purgatory, but I know that body will be there one way or another. And so you'll go through some form of purification in that, what I'm going to call spiritual body, that pneumatikon soma. You will definitely go through that. But I think once purgatory is completed and you move into the domain of heaven, then I think you go through a second transformation. And I'm not sure when it will be, whether there's a delay or maybe immediately upon the completion of purgatory. We just don't know. But at some point or another, there is an intense glorification that will take place along the lines of Christ's glorification, which goes beyond the spiritualizing of his body, of his physical body. So it goes beyond just having transphysical qualities. It goes beyond, having, a remedy for and healing for all diseases. It goes beyond overcoming of pain. It goes right to a glorification where we become like him, for we will see him as he is. And that's either going to happen at the end of the world, or it'll happen sometime between, our completion of purgatory and when we are incorporated into the kingdom of heaven. But specifically when, I don't know. I hope that answers your question.
And yes, it does. And wow, that is fantastic and awesome. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Paul. Great question. It's good to have you here with us today. Our next call comes from David. He's listening in Lyle, Illinois. Hi, David. Good afternoon.
Oh, hello, Drew. We haven't talked in a while. How are you?
I'm well. Good to hear your voice.
That's good. Father, and I've watched you often, and finally I get to talk to you.
Oh, sure.
My question is, if those souls that are already in heaven, fully experiencing the beatific vision, certainly those souls have all, they are totally fulfilled. They are not in want of anything more.
That is
so
correct.
They certainly don't feel like they're missing their bodies, like there's something missing. So then, what is the purpose of having the resurrected body if the soul already experiences the beatific vision and has all that to fulfill it has all well, that the, it is already.
Yeah, you don't want to say it that quite that way, and here's the reason why, is that the soul by itself is not our complete being. A human being is not complete in its in our soul alone. We really do have to have that what I'm going to call corporeal component, but I don't want the word corporeal to mean. I just mean a bodily component. It doesn't mean a physical body component. So we do have to have some kind of a bodily component because that's who we are. And that's who the risen Christ is. Christ didn't give up his embodied component, his corporeal component. And he, if it were just the soul of Christ without his embodiment in some sense, his transfigured and transformed embodiment, right, then he would not be complete as a human being. So it's like we are meant to be a transformed bodily and souled component. That's what's going to be completely fulfilled in the beatific vision. The soul alone will not be fulfilled in the beatific vision. That would be kind of a Platonic version of Christian heaven.
Well, stay with us. When we come back, we'll take a few more calls. We're taking a look at the resurrected body. Will your resurrected body be able to eat? Do you carry the wounds? Say you are a martyr and you lost your fingers like St. Isaac Job. What happened? Is your body restored? We'll take a look at that and much more when I return. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio, getting you connected.
Yeah, great to be with you. Good call, Jake. A little David Bowie there. It's good to be back with you. In about 10 minutes, we'll pray the chaplet. If you're just joining me now, maybe tuning in a little bit early, I have been speaking with Father Robert Spitzer, one of my favorites, and we're taking a look at a reality that you and I will all encounter, and that is a resurrected body. You know, what will our resurrected body look like? If you have been born with some sort of physical anomaly, maybe you've had an amputation, maybe you are martyred. You know, I take a look at St. Isaac Job, who had his fingers cut off, or Jesus Christ, who was nailed to a cross. When he appeared, he bore the wounds of his crucifixion. Is the body restored in full? Do you somehow, with a resurrected body, do you continue to keep the battle scars, if you will, to show the victory of Christ over sin and death in our own bodies? Father, let's pick it up on that point. I mean, Christ came with his glorified body, beautiful and all, with the marks of his crucifixion. What happens to many of the martyrs and the saints? What happens to somebody who says, hey, I've been born with a hunchback or whatever it might be? Explain the restoration, if you will, of the body and perhaps why Christ came bearing his wounds.
Yeah, the resurrected body would be not only restored to what it was, it will be restored to what it was meant to be, tati anenai, right? What it was meant to be. So what it is fully intended, its fully intended possibility. So that's what the resurrected body will become. In terms of just the wounds and things of that nature, yes, they will be completely restored and, of course, completely transformed into the transphysical state of the body. It goes beyond physical laws when that transformation takes place. Now, with respect to would you maintain the battle scars, you certainly could, but they won't hurt you anymore. They won't impede you anymore. They won't be in any way, impeding your transphysicality or your glory. So those wounds will be like signs of glory that Jesus was not ashamed of, right? He's not ashamed of the wounds of the cross. Indeed, quite the opposite. They are truly the manifestation of the love that he held out for the world by his complete self-sacrifice that he accepted freely accepted upon himself. So all those things will be, as it were, simultaneous. The wounds may be present, but it will be signs of great glory and honor. It will be a part in integral to the glory of his risen body.
Gotcha. All right, let's take a few more calls. You know how quickly time goes. We'll go to John. He's listening in Las Vegas. Hi, John. Good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you for your, but Father Spitzer, thank you for the blessing of your ministry. It's wonderful.
Well, thank you.
I had a question that's always kind of perplexed me. It seems that most people in their lifetime, they are often in a state of grace and sometimes not in a state of grace. And that, of course, if they die not in a state of grace, they would, you know, that would cause damnation. But it also seems that when people die is random. And I know that people can't randomly go to hell or heaven. So I'm not sure how to reconcile that.
Yeah, you know, it's a really great question. And, you know, a lot of theologians have batted it around, and a lot of saints have batted it around. But here's my best summary answer to that question. First of all, you're right. God's not just going to let the randomness of the event, you know, take the full precedence. I think everybody has a moment at which true freedom can express itself relative to the way that they did live their lives. So I do think that there is a moment where Christ, you know, kind of, even if it, you don't see it, right? You're looking at a person, you say, well, that corpse just died, you know. But nevertheless, can Christ appear to that person even in their dying state, even in the last second before their death, in their dying state, and give them that freedom to sort of say, forgive me, for I have sinned? And I truly believe that. I not only believe that because people like St. John Vianney, right, says, you know, here's this guy, he dives off this bridge in order to commit suicide, and yet he comes back and assures his wife, yeah, God actually said that on the way down, you know, he repented when God appeared, and so forth. So do I think that these kinds of events can happen, you know, on the brink of death? Yes, I do. And I do think God does give us that chance. So if a person has been living a he's been trying to live a good life, and maybe something happened, and something random occurred, and maybe he fell a little bit, and then, you know, he got in a plane accident that was completely unexpected, would God just say, that's just the luck of the draw? I do not believe that, not for a moment. God's justice is just through and through, and merciful through and through. He gives us the opportunity to use our freedom to its optimal extent, even if we experience a random event. Now, that's my belief. Of course, that's not a church doctrine per se, but church doctrine allows that to be an orthodox interpretation of what could happen. All so right. That's
let's do this,
that's
Father.
My best answer for you.
Thank you, John. We only have a minute or two left. A lot of people have been holding for a long time. John in Philadelphia has been hanging out here, too. John, thanks for your patience.
Hey, thank you. It's been delightful listening to you gentlemen with your great gift of eloquence. And, Father, the way you color words, even though you might be challenged, you know, visually, you project vision and you color everything so beautifully. So thank you for the gift, and thank you for sharing it. Your wisdom is seems to be fathomless.
Yeah, no
problem. Just a quick question. Are you familiar with the, I guess it was a study, an international study, and there were 5 million people reported to have had this life-after-death experience. And I was surprised by that great number, and maybe with the population of the world, maybe 5 million is not a lot, but I was surprised that, you know, like 5 million people have had this life-after-death experience where they come back and they say, I saw heaven, hell, purgatory, I visited with family members, et cetera.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I've seen
even blind people, lady died on the operating table, and she says, you know, this place is dirty. Up on top, you got dust, and there's a green rubber glove up there, okay? Go get it. And she was blind before, and she was blind afterwards, but during that out-of-body experience, she disclosed how filthy it was up there.
I love that. John, we only have about 2 minutes left, so I'm going to give Father the final thoughts, but thanks for your kind words.
Here's a quick answer. I'm not familiar with the 5 million study, but I sure am familiar with truly dozens of good peer-reviewed, medically-oriented scientific studies of near-death experiences that have manifested it. And then just to let you know, there are 2 massive studies of blind people during clinical death, and 81% of blind people, that's people blind from birth, do see for the first time when they're clinically dead, having a near-death experience, when their bodies are basically, non-compost, they're flat EEG, right. Fixed and dilated pupils, no gag reflex, et cetera, a few neurons sputtering in the lower brain. So, yes, you're absolutely right about all those things. I'm not sure about the 5 million, but if you take a look at the number of people in these multiple studies that have been done, it certainly is in the hundreds of thousands of well-studied people, and maybe there are bigger studies. I know Gallup has done some really big, huge studies, but they're not the same as peer-reviewed medical studies, but they have ascertained that many, many people, large population, do have these near-death experiences. Somewhere in the neighborhood of about 20% of people who die have manifest, remembered near-death experiences that can be studied after the fact.
Father, we'll bring it back. We can talk about that. It's a subject of mine that I just love. So it deserves a lot more time. But thank you for being here. Of course, if anyone wants more information, they can tap into that wealth of material at the Majus Center. It's majuscenter.com or spitzercenter.org. We'll catch up again soon. Happy Easter, Father.
Happy Easter to you, Drew.
We'll pray the chaplet when I return. Stay with me.